As we begin this evening, I want to tell two stories. The first story is the kind of story that Mennonites don't tell, but other Christians do. And they're the kind of stories that Anabaptists find troubling. The second story is probably the most recognized story in Anabaptist circles. The first story comes from this book, American Heroes by Stephen Mansfield. And the story is entitled, The Message of a Missile. And I think instead of telling this story, I'm going to read it. On a cool, quiet January morning, Corporal Rick Garrett was shaving in the shower trailer at Camp Victory, Iraq. Wrapped in a towel and enjoying the energy he felt from a good night's sleep, he began thinking about the months he had left overseas. Many questions filled his mind. Would the war get even bloodier? Would any of his buddies be killed? Would he do his duty well? In fact, would he even survive? And then another question. It was a prayer, really, formed itself in his mind. God, are you able to protect me over here? The words had just become a conscious thought when Corporal Garrett heard a deafening crash. It was the sound of the trailer door shattering. A rocket-propelled grenade had pierced the door and was now flying through the middle of the trailer. In an instant, the projectile flew past Corporal Garrett, lightly creasing his stomach en route and embedded itself in the trailer wall opposite the door. For a moment, Garrett was frozen in shock, expecting the RPG to explode, but it did not. Realizing he might have a moment to escape, the corporal ran to the gaping hole where the door had been and hurled himself through it to the ground several feet below. Jumping up as quickly as he could, he sprinted from the trailer while shouting a warning to those in the nearby trailers. Dozens of soldiers braced themselves for an explosion, and yet nothing happened. The RPG never exploded. It was a dud. Garrett picked himself up from the ground and began laughing with relief. As the crowd gathered and began congratulating him for his luck, he remembered the question he'd been asking God. Can you protect me over here? It seemed that God had answered. In case the message hadn't been clear enough, though, there was something more. When the ordnance specialists examined the unexploded RPG, they found a message had been scratched onto it. This was not uncommon. Insurgents often painted or scratched some message on the missiles they fired as an added insult to their American enemy. And an insertion here, I don't know, I've heard that it's not just the insurgents that would paint these messages on missiles, that American soldiers would do the same. But the message on this particular missile had a special meaning to Corporal Garrett. It read simply, from the God of the American soldiers. Apparently, an insurgent had intended the message as a cruel insult. Corporal Garrett knew better. Whatever the insurgents meant to say, he knew that his God was saying, in dramatic terms, yes, I can protect you over here, for I am the God of the American soldier. The second story. The year is 1569. The place, Asperine, Holland. And the man is Dirk Willems. The Martyr's Mirror describes Dirk Willems as pious and devout, a faithful brother, a follower of Jesus Christ. Because of Dirk's faith, he was sought by the authorities, he was captured and imprisoned. Due to the conditions of his imprisonment, he lost a lot of weight. And that's possibly why, we don't know for sure, but that's possibly why he was able to escape from his prison cell They had bars that were fairly narrow, but somehow he was able to get out and to lower himself to the ground. Again, it seems like he had made a rope from some strips of cloth that he got from his bed, lowered himself to the ground. He was free. He began to run for safety. But soon he was spotted by a guard. And that guard gave chase, and the Dirk began to run across a lake that was frozen over, but it was only lightly frozen. But again, probably because of the weight loss that he'd experienced, he was able to make it across safely. But the guard that was chasing him did not, broke through the ice, and was in danger of losing his life. Seeing this, Dirk Willems turns around, comes back, and helps his would-be captor to safety. And the picture we have now seems to be that on one side of this pond or lake was Dirk Willems and the guard. On the other side was the guard's boss, the burgomaster. And the guard was saying, I want to let him go. He saved my life. The burgomaster says, no, you must rearrest him. And so Dirk Willems was rearrested. Once again, he was in prison. This time, the conditions were even more severe. He was condemned to death by burning. All of Dirk Willems' property was taken and given to the state church. On the day of his death, there was a strong east wind that drove the fire away from his upper body as he was there at the stake where they were burning him. And so he suffered a long and lingering death. The records from the town downwind a mile or so, they have in it that he cried out over 70 times, "Oh, my Lord, my God." The judge who was present on horseback finally had enough and gave instructions for them just to kill him. "Dispatch him quickly," he said, turned around and left. And so Dirk Willems died. He died because of his commitment to Christ, because of his willingness to save his captor from death. These are two stories that have a radically different worldview behind them, a different way of understanding and seeing reality. And I'd like to compare that different picture for a moment here. In the first story, we hear of a world where God's loyalties are to nations rather than to his followers. We see a world where Christians are expected to use force to promote justice. If Christians are going to be faithful in that first story, then they need to be a part of the military. In that first story, we see a world where the enemies of my country are the same as God's enemies. And we see a world where we can know the power of God that power is best seen in our ability to avoid being killed by the enemy and the power to kill. The second story tells of a world where Christians are called to lay down their lives for others, even if that other is a sworn enemy. It tells of a world where God's power is best seen in the ability to save the life of someone who's trying to kill me. We're looking at five words that describe the Anabaptist worldview. And so far we've talked about devotion, we've talked about brotherhood, and we've talked about separation. In this session, we want to develop the next S, and then in the last session, the L. Now, I do want to just say that these emphases are not exclusive to Anabaptists. You're going to find these emphases in other groups at times and places as well. But these are emphases that have been a part of who we are as a people. The story of Dirk Willems highlights a fourth emphasis of Anabaptism, and that is that Anabaptists emphasize sacrificial love. But what do we mean by that? What is sacrificial love? And to help answer that question, I want to ask another question. It's this. What does Jesus want his followers to do about the evil that's in the world? How does he want us to do anything about injustice in the world? How does he want us to fight evil? Now, we could make a list of different ways to engage evil in the world. We could counsel. We could give gifts to needy people. We could fight evil by killing violent folks. Osama bin Laden comes to mind. We could fight evil by making laws against evil, by enforcing those laws, by writing letters to people who make laws, encouraging them to make good laws. I'm just making a list here of ways that we could engage the evil that is present in our world. We could march for just causes. We could sign petitions that promote what's good rather than what isn't. We could preach. We could teach. We could vote for the better leaders. We could just get away from it. These are all responses to evil in our world. We could die for the undeserving. But what does Jesus, what does he call his followers to in this realm? How does he want you and I to work against evil in our world? Now, I'm going to suggest that we could place all of these different approaches on a continuum, on a line from one basic approach, one extreme approach, to another extreme approach. At the one end of this continuum are coercive means of fighting evil. That is where we force someone else to do what is good. We know what is good and we make others do that thing. On the other end of the continuum would be compelling means of fighting evil. And here it's more of a focus on trying to convince other people of what is good, and helping them to embrace that. Let's continue our comparisons of these two approaches. On the coercive side, this would be open to violent approaches where I'm willing to hurt someone else in order for good to be accomplished. I'm willing to kill somebody if that killing them will make it better for others. On the other side, we have sacrificial approaches where instead of hurting someone so that good can result, I'm willing to be hurt or sacrifice so that good can result. The coercive side is retributive. It's an eye for an eye. That's the form of justice. The other side is love, overcoming evil with good. The first side, the violent side, others hurt. The sacrificial side, I hurt. All of these different means of fighting evil that we put up here can be put along this continuum at different places. And so I'm just suggesting maybe where some of them might fit. Perhaps we could illustrate the difference between the two ends of this spectrum this way. I don't know the local area well enough to personalize this story, but let's say that you have some local store down here in Wagner where, it's a nice little community store. A lot of the locals frequent there. And they decided that in order to help the bottom line, they're going to start selling pornography. And the Christians in the area decide, no, that's not a good thing. They want to work against that evil. And so they get a petition up. And they get all the Christians in the area to sign that petition. And they soon get maybe 300 signatures of people saying, Christian people saying, we're not going to do business in this store unless you take those magazines out. That would be a way of fighting evil. Now, what can often happen, and what often does happen in a situation like that, is that once the store owner gets that petition and says, ooh, I'm going to lose a lot of business if I don't take these magazines out, he might do it. But then some of the other folks in the community say, no, wait, why did you take that out? And he tells the story, and they say, well, hey, we can play that game too. And so they get a petition together, and they wind up maybe with 400 signatures saying, if you don't put this in, we're going to not do business with you. And notice that the issue has stopped being one. It stopped being an issue of what is right or wrong, what is true or evil. It is now a question of who has the most power, who has the most coercive influence to get their will. Now compare that approach, which really is on toward the coercive or violent end of the spectrum, compare that approach to what I understand happened with Jack Eckerd of Eckerd Drugstores. Chuck Colson of Prison Fellowship fame became friends with Jack Eckerd, the CEO of that large chain of drugstores. And as they got to know each other, Chuck Colson led Jack Eckerd to the Lord. And one day when Eckerd was walking through his stores, he noticed the kind of magazines that they were selling. And he says, he went to his board of directors and he said, we've got to stop this. This is not right to be for us to be selling this kind of a magazine. His board of directors, his CFO, his chief financial officer said, Eckerd, you're crazy. This is a significant economic component of the health of Eckerd Drugs. And his response was, it doesn't matter. It's wrong for us to be tearing apart the infrastructure of our society in this way. And so if we can't make it without selling that, then I'm not interested in having stores. Take the pornography out of our stores, he said. Understand that the 1,700 Eckerd stores did take it out, and there was a ripple effect that caused the removal from over 11,000 drugstores of other chains as well because of the stand that Eckerd took. That was on the compelling approach to fighting evil. We said that Anabaptists emphasized sacrificial love. In other words, it's the means of fighting evil that are at that end of the spectrum that Christ calls us to. That's the understanding that Anabaptists bring. Now, sacrificial love then has two components. Fighting evil in that way has two components to it. Let's take a look at those. The first component has to do with what God is doing in us. How he's changing us, what the kind of person that he's making his followers into. And the second component of sacrificial love has to do with how God wants to address evil through us. So let's take a look at those two in a little more detail for a text, and I hope this isn't too small for you to read. From Matthew 22, and one of them, a lawyer, asked Jesus a question to test him. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said to him, "You shall love your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." We've looked at this in an earlier section, but once again, we see something of God's heart toward us, what he's inviting us into, what he is calling us to, and that is to be lovers. Lovers of him, first of all. This is the great and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then from Matthew 5:44, "But I," as Jesus speaking again, "say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." What is it that God is doing in us? God is making his followers into lovers, to lovers of himself, to lovers of brother, to lovers of neighbor, even lovers of enemies. That's the kind of person that he wants to make you and I into. This is not something we merely do, a way we live in the world. It's the kind of person he's wanting to make us into. And this is an incredibly tall order. I wonder sometimes when I'm going to be more of a lover of enemies. But I do understand that this is the kind of transforming work that he's wanting to do in my life and in yours, all of his children. This is the kind of person he wants to make us into. And this is part of the reason why this question of sacrificial love is not just, or sometimes we talk about it as non-resistance. It is not just a tack onto the gospel. This is at the heart of what God is, his program of transformation of people and of society has to do with changing who we are into a different kind of person, a person who loves, even when it is excruciatingly difficult, that our natural response becomes one of love. So sacrificial love is not something merely that we do. It is something we are becoming. The second component, two passages, the first from 2 Corinthians 10. "For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does." Remember our continuum. And I see Jesus calling us here saying, I want you to be fighting evil in the world, but the approach that I'm offering to you, the way I want you, my followers, to fight evil is going to be different than the way most people are fighting. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. And we see something of what the weapons are in Romans 12. "Do not take revenge, my friends. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil." This is not passivity. This is an active assault. Overcome evil with good. This is a call to anchor our approaches to fighting evil on that sacrificial love, that compelling end of the spectrum. And so we can say that Christ's followers fight evil through sacrificial love and redemptively prophetic presence. We live in our lives in a way where we're calling people to truth. We live our lives so that people say, whatever it is you have, whatever it is you're becoming, that's compelling. That's attractive. Anabaptists emphasize sacrificial love. What are the practices that train us to respond to evil in this way? I'm going to suggest two practices that have been a part of Anabaptist people for a while. The first is voluntary service. For the last 70 years, Mennonites have promoted giving a year or more in unpaid service to a service or ministry. I don't know what percentage of our young people go into voluntary service, but I know it's been an emphasis in the past, and I hope it's an emphasis that continues. In fact, I'd love to see it grow. Whether it was 1W or Northern Youth Programs, AMA, MDS, SLM, CAM, Hillcrest, Faith Mission Home, DNI, there's just a lot of opportunities to go and volunteer time, to give time to others. And I've talked to quite a few volunteers over the years, and many have testified that working for others, on behalf of others, without pay, was very hard and very satisfying. It was hard because they said it surfaced a lot of hidden selfishness in their lives. They also said it was satisfying because it gave them a taste of this ironic joy and fulfillment that comes when we seek the good of others, when we sacrifice and serve. Voluntary service is a practice that cultivates an active engagement of what's wrong in our world through sacrificial love. A second practice among us, and I think maybe this is one that might be declining in some degrees, is the writing and telling of stories, particularly stories of overcoming evil with good. Historically, we have been a people of story. So much so that our best known book is a storybook, The Martyr's Mirror. And here's a quick little aside. There is a Mennonite book that has more, or an Anabaptist book, I should say, that has more editions than any other. And it's not the Martyr's Mirror, and it's not the complete writings of Minna Simons. It's one I've asked many, many of my students over the years, and no one can guess which one it is. In fact, most of them have never heard of it. But it's the prayer book for earnest Christians. And for a lot moderate conservatives, it's a surprise that there even is a prayer book from an Anabaptist perspective. But back to the Martyr's Mirror. In the 1600s, the church in Holland was very concerned about the lack of commitment that they were seeing in the people in their churches. And so the leadership decided to commission a collection of stories that told about the faithfulness of the martyrs in the 1500s. So this is just 100 years out, and they're collecting these stories. Tilman Van Braught is the one who was appointed to do the collection. He collected about 800 stories. They were published in the first edition of the Martyr's Mirror, along with 103 copper etchings that Jan Lyken did. And those plates are still around. You can observe those at some museum. And so here's a page with one of Lyken's etchings, of course, the one that we saw earlier in the story of Dirk Willems. The first edition had around 1,300 pages. It weighed 17 and a half pounds, and it measured 16 inches by 7 inches. That was published in 1675. And then move forward another 100 years here in the United States, 1745. The Skippack Mennonite ministers, once again, were feeling like there was just a lack of commitment, a lack of understanding of what it means to follow Christ. And they said, what can we do about this? And the answer was, we need to tell our stories, the stories of our faith. And it's reminiscent of what God commanded the children of Israel to do, to tell the stories of the Exodus. And there was a sense in which it seemed like God was saying, your children, when they hear those stories, the impact will be similar to actually going through that experience. And so there was a, they brought over the Dutch edition of the Martyr's Mirror. They had it translated into German. And Peter Miller from the Ephrata Cloisters, if you ever get a chance to visit there in Ephrata, that's worthwhile doing. They asked Peter Miller, one of the proprietor there, to do the translation. Peter Miller knew 14 languages. He helped to translate the Declaration of Independence into seven different languages. And so in 1751, the Martyr's Mirror was printed here in the United States. It was the largest book to be printed up to that point in colonial America. An ironic part of that story is that a few years later, during the Revolutionary War, Washington's troops heard that there was a number of unsold copies of Martyr's Mirror there at the cloisters, and so they went in one night and confiscated all the remaining copies for the purpose of using those martyrs' mirrors as wadding for their muskets. I say all of that just to make the case again of how important the stories of faithfulness to Christ have been to our people. And this is one of the ways that we have cultivated an understanding of sacrificial love. That tradition has continued in books like Coals of Fire and the story, the overcoming good with evil stories that are told in that book. I suspect the picture there on the cover is another one of those stories that a lot of Mennonites know, the story of Pastor Peter and the thatched roof. I won't tell that this evening. I would, though, like to tell a story of overcoming evil with good that comes from Northwest Pennsylvania, and it's a story of Eva Jones. She is a dearly loved lady that attends Meadville Mennonite Chapel. She was born in 1925 here in the South. She moved north in the 40s and married a man named Webster. Webster and Eva, Sister Eva, had two children. But somewhere along the line, several years into their marriage, another woman named Emma came into the picture. And Emma decided that she was going to have Webster. And she set about to get him. And she was successful. Webster moved out from his wife, moved in with Emma, and soon he asked for a divorce. But his wife, Sister Eva, she said, I refused him. I refused him in the name of the Lord, she said. But it wasn't long before Webster came back to Sister Eva and said, Would you take me back? And she did. But it wasn't long before he left her again for Emma. And over the next 20 years, it was back and forth and back and forth. Webster living as he pleased, coming and going, and sometimes in that process, treating Eva brutally. I had the opportunity numerous times to talk with Sister Eva, and one occasion I just asked her, I said, what was it like? I said, that had to be so difficult. Oh, she said, it was horrible. She said, I wanted to kill him. But, and then when she'd say that, she'd say, but the grace of God restrained me. And then, in the mid-80s, her husband Webster had a stroke. Eva was in her 60s, and she nursed him in her own home until he died in 1986. By her testimony, Webster came to be a follower of Christ too during those later years. But the story's not over. Within a short period of time after Webster's death, Emma the other woman came down with cancer, and she too asked Sister Eva if she would take care of her. And while Sister Eva was not her primary caregiver, she spent a lot of time and did help to take care of this lady who had robbed her of her husband, robbed her of so many dreams in her life. She did that until Emma too died in 1989. And amazingly, Emma came to know the Lord while receiving care from Sister Eva. God wants us to fight evil in our world. God is calling us to live our lives in ways that compel and attract others to the truth. God is making His children into people who are like their Father, who love even enemies. And let us be clear, Sister Eva was an evil fighter. She was fighting evil in the world. She was doing it through sacrificial love. I find her testimony and many, many other stories of this kind of sacrificial love to cause me to ask the question, God, how do you want me to fight evil? How do you want us, our congregation, to fight evil in the world? And I think of people like Joe, a man that I know in our community who spends hours with a suicidal neighbor who is threatening to do violence to his family. I think of Darrell, a business owner who offers jobs, employment, to people that others consider undesirable, ex-convicts, recovering alcohol and drug addicts. I think of Norm, who can't get around very well anymore. But instead of just sitting around or playing solitaire, he spends a lot of time praying and knotting comforters for other people. Sacrificial love. I want to offer, though, some cautions here. This is an emphasis of ours. But as we come to a close of this session, I want to talk about some areas where this emphasis can go wrong. We emphasize sacrificial love as the God-honoring, God-ordained way of fighting evil in the world. And this in contrast to serving in the military or getting involved in the criminal justice system. But sometimes it becomes nothing more than just self-protection. It's not fighting evil at all, but it's a way for us to maintain our safe, cozy little lives where we can avoid sacrifice. Our non-resistance can be the language we use to cloak our unwillingness to sacrifice and to suffer. And when that's the case, then non-resistance or sacrificial love is a farce. It's a lie. Rather than a way of fighting evil, it becomes evil. I remember during the Gulf War, I was talking with one of our neighbors, and he said, "Stephen, I've just been called up to service in Iraq." And he said, "It means I'll need to leave, be there for 2 years. He had a wife and several children. His wife joined us as we were talking, and as we were there, she and heard her husband talking, she started crying. And it was clearly something was really difficult for them. He didn't want to go, but his commitment to his country was strong. And it was a commitment that compelled him to sacrifice and serve. And if our commitment to sacrificial love or non-resistance is merely our way of avoiding similar sacrifice, then we deserve scorn and we should repent. A second caution. We emphasize sacrificial love, but sometimes this emphasis is rather dim when it involves the people close around me. Loving enemies? That's right, yes. But the brother that's farming next to me? Not so much. The forgiveness that the Amish offered after the Nickel Mines tragedy was a beautiful picture of sacrificial love. But can I forgive the sister who's criticized me to others behind my back? I think it's Gary Miller, the writer on finance and business, that has said that one sour business dealing with a neighbor will negate hundreds of distributed tracts. Sacrificial love is much more attractive as an idea than it is as a lived reality. Jesus said, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it." Anabaptists emphasize sacrificial love. Four words: brotherhood, separation, sacrificial love, and devotion. In our last session, we'll take a look at our final emphasis of Anabaptism. As we close this section, I find it interesting that the two most often quoted passages by the early Anabaptists were, first of all, and by the way, we find these from the Martyr's Mirror, and most of the times these are quotes that are found when the Anabaptists were in court. And these are the two passages that they would quote more often than any other. The first one is Matthew 28:19. "Go, and while you're going, make disciples of all nations, teaching them to observe everything that I've commanded you." The second, Psalm 24:1, "The earth is the Lord's." And in their mind, this one was connected to the first. They would say something like this: "Since the earth is God's, there's no place where we should be, where we shouldn't testify to His glory. There's no place that we should not live in a way that calls and attracts people to Jesus Christ." Our forefathers set the bar high. And I would just say, may our enthusiasm for sacrificial love translate into vibrant evangelism and missions and discipleship in our generation. This opportunity we have to fight evil with sacrificial love calls for our best energy, our best creativity, and innovation as individuals and as churches.